Welcome to the Calgary Sessions. This is episode number 96. I'm your host, Jeff Humphreys. Today's guest, this is another one. When this guest said yes to come on the show, I was like, holy shit, I can't believe it. So
when I was invited to be a guest, I said the same thing.
So please go name and who you are.
I'm Jeff DeBoer. I'm a Calgary-born artist, visual artist, I guess. Or am I? I'm also a very proud artisan. I guess my claim to fame is the body of work that I started back when I was a student at Art College in 1986. I made my first suit of armor for a mouse.
In 86?
1986. So I guess I'm coming on 36, 37 years of working on these.
No way. Yeah. What art college were you? Was it?
I was in the jewelry department.
Okay.
Yeah, of all things.
What was this? Was it? Was it ACAD back then, or what was it called?
It was just ACAD, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. ACA, actually. Then they became ACAD, and now they're the Alberta University of the Arts.
Amazing. So I had no idea you were born and raised in Calgary, so that's just like, it all gets cooler for me from here. So, so the gist of the show is I take the guests back as far as, well, they take themselves back as far as they want to go. How they grew up, where they grew up, what inspired them. You know, what roles different people play in their lives. And then we kind of weave our way to where you are today and all the little nuances along the way. So go ahead, take it back.
I'll take it back. When I was 5 years old, I wasn't like all the other kids in the playground, even starting at kindergarten. I think I liked art and drawing, and which all kids do. But I remember maybe 5 or 6 years old, I saw sort of a docudrama of the life of Leonardo da Vinci on television. And I was hooked. I thought this was the most fascinating person, the most fascinating work, just a super smart human being. And I kind of wanted to be like him, if I could. So where other kids, when I was growing up, were all about hockey, all the other boys seemed to be a little bit rough, tough, getting into fights. I was a little bit more hypersensitive, a little bit of more of an outsider right from the very beginning. So I saw the world as kind of a hostile place. And not fitting in, I guess when you're a little kid, you find yourself wandering around the playground sometimes, because I certainly didn't play soccer with the other boys. I guess I kind of hung out with the girls. And I think, you know, from grade one to grade six, even sort of questioning my own existence, why am I here? And seeing things very differently. Funny enough, one of my most inspiring things as a kid, ironically, I grew up in a Catholic school system. So you can imagine what that was
like. Me too.
I found that watching David Carradine's Kung Fu TV series back in the 70s. Mm. I actually would like the scenes with the monks when they were talking about Buddhist philosophy and all these wonderful stories and teachings that were part of that show. And I actually became really fascinated with Buddhism, and I thought, I think I'm probably a Buddhist, and I knew that probably from the age of 9 or 10. So there you are. You don't fit into your religion, you don't fit into the culture of the kids growing up, and you're trying to justify your own existence. And all through school, you know, a little bit of an underachiever, I always thought that normal was 50%. I could get 50% grades, I was normal or average or whatever that was. So I never had good grades. I just kind of made my way through life. But my father was a sheet metal fabricator. So we built a garage. My dad never parked his car in the garage. And so I had access to all these metal tools. And even early, I made my first suit of chainmail in 1979. And I had this fantasy that I would, maybe even something like the opposite of bowling for Columbine, that I would go to school, go to my grad wearing a suit of armor, like almost like a reveal of myself.
What was the fascination with armor back then? What inspired you?
Yeah, I guess we've got to go back to that too. Even as, again, we go back to 5 or 6 years old, going through the Glenbow Museum as a kid. Mm. I remember holding my mom's hand, going to the armor collection, and I was completely haunted by what I saw. You know, these beautiful forms of people past. They're all obviously dead now, but this was once worn. the stories, the magic, the you know, just the whole romance of what armor sort of represented. I realized that it was used in military contexts, but again, you start thinking about it as a beautiful form, as an art form too, because historically, armor for sure was used on the battlefield, but it also did become an art form later on and inspired clothing and fashion. It was the gift of kings to other kings, so the it was sort of the height of technology too. So this fusion of art, technology, politics, ego, romance, all those things are fused into one form that is also kinesiology, because it's based on movement, martial arts. All of these things are all rolled into a single form that can cross so many boundaries in terms of how you interpret it. You know, is it art, or is it an artifact? Is it all of these things all rolled into one? Like, I guess maybe that's a much more adult view, but as a kid, I read stories on knights and all these sorts of things, but I also, again, as I was saying, this sort of fascination with Buddhism, even in high school, I started to read Buddhist texts, and, you know, there was the Shamhala, which was the Tibetan Book of the Warrior, and I read that book, and that changed my life, because in that book, they talk about young warriors, and they describe them as having these little felt horns that are later on going to grow into these great antlers. But as children, other children can sense these felt horns, and they're hard on that child for some reason, or they're afraid of that child, or they don't understand that child. You know, we all have our bullies. So you get this sort of feedback loop where you're kind of this person that almost invites this sort of experience from others that's going to forge you into the person you're meant to be, if that makes sense. So reading that gave me a lot of strength and a lot of courage to not worry about being like anybody else. I wasn't ever going to be, so why not explore my own identity? So that's where the idea of armor came in, is that I just didn't want to wear the same kind of suit that everyone was going to wear to their grad. So I started building a suit of armor in secret. And maybe it's like a superhero. You're forging, you know, like Iron Man is secretly building the suit of armor to reach a potential that nobody understands. That's something you have to explore yourself. And, you know, I've always said something interesting about my 36-year journey with the cat and mouse armor work is, for 36 years, I thought I was making them. It turned out they were making me. The kinds of changes that I've had to make in myself to develop my skill, to find my patience, to have a critical eye, to not, you know, not cut corners. All these things are sort of noble things. You know, people say, you know, Jeff, you're so patient. Like patience is some kind of super virtue. Why does it have to be a virtue? I think patience can be a luxury. Taking the time to do something is, maybe that's the partly lost art too. And then again, in Buddhism or in martial arts, I also have 27 years of martial arts training.
Which also, just going to slide that in there.
But that whole notion of mastery, how many people earnestly pursue this idea that potentially they could find mastery in something in their life. And that's always been really sexy to me, this idea that someday I might be called a master. You know, it was like the idea that maybe somebody would come to you as a master and you'd have some great wisdom to dispense at some point. So all those forces are sort of rolling through your head in high school. And of course, you can't wait to get out. And when it's over, it's over.
Yeah.
And now you're going to find a whole new group of people to hang out with. And I, you know, funny enough, I was watching back in the early 70s, they used to have a TV show called Real People, I think it was. And they did a story on a medieval recreation society in the United States called the Society for Creative Anachronism. And there's all these guys wearing armor running around beating each other up with wooden sticks. And I thought, that's for me. And I found that there was a club here in Calgary. So for after high school, I found the club, and I was able to come into the workshop of a blacksmith by the name of Dan Boss, and he was building armor for people. So, and he was doing it in a different way. And I started building armor with him, and I sort of worked with him building my own armor and participating in this club for that first 3 years until he left. And then I stayed in the club and continued doing martial medieval combat for 17 years.
Wow.
And then at a certain point I had to stop. Mm-hmm. but it was this combination of this sort of fascination in history and then my experience with Dan Boss building armor. And then in 1984, I went into the art college, a college at the time.
Yeah.
I had really good drawing skills, I guess. And, you know, I was, and believe it or not, I actually was getting good grades for the first time in my whole life. I got scholarships.
Oh, wow.
The first year, I took all, they take all these different courses and, you know, ceramics and sculpture and commercial art. And I always thought, you know, maybe I'll just become a commercial artist and, you know, have a nice house, drive a Porsche, work for an ad agency or something like that. But I took that bloody jewelry course. And I signed up for commercial art, and then I just got sick. Something was wrong, deeply, deeply wrong. I thought, okay, I'll tell you what, Jeff. The only problem I have with the jewelry department is I don't like making jewelry.
Minor detail.
So, again, it's sort of weird because you're not going to fit in again.
Mm-hmm.
Could I treat jewelry like a commercial visual art form? I love the skills. Could I be making things instead of jewelry? Mm-hmm. So I decided, okay, I'm going to become a jewelry major. So in 1985, I'm a jewelry major, and I'm giving it everything I've got. I mean, I have to work for a living. I have to save my money. I'm not rich. I didn't drink. I went to bed as early as I could. I slept. I went to school, and I worked, and I was just dedicated. And I think that the instructors at that time, oh, hey, my phone's going off.
Don't worry. It's happened before.
Turn that switch off. I wonder if that's a sign. The instructors, I think, saw something in me. And, you know, kind of interesting, too, is that my girlfriend, who's now my wife, we've been together since I was 19.
Wow.
So we were over 40 years. She was putting me through school too. Hmm. You know, like you think about risk. So you imagine putting your boyfriend through art college, you know. But everybody seemed to see something in me. And you know, also I've been kind of a clown for a long time in my life too. And people didn't think I had the kind of focus that I really have. But I really focused, and the instructors started to share me all of their secrets. Mm-hmm. And I was doing extra projects and overtime. And the jewelry department was interesting because not only was it a technical department, but they also kind of had a culture of conceptualism too, believe it or not. So I was getting, you know, certainly in all my other classes, sculpture classes and other things like that, I was certainly participating in that art conversation. But in 1985, in the winter semester, it kind of all came together, this history of my building armor. Then, and now my jewelry scale was this small, this tiny little thing. What could I build that's armor, that's now in this tiny scale? And of course you have a conceptual education here. So if I build a miniature suit of armor, is it just a model? So what have you achieved? What's small? And oh my God, you know, you think about the lines and shape of a mouse. It's so cute. It's so fascinating. Can I do it? So you have all these worlds coming together now, the new skills, this new scale, this history, and it just kind of all came together, and I made this suit of armor for a mouse. And I remember going to my critique.
I can't imagine when you show up with this thing what's about to happen.
And I put that mouse on the table, and I've never seen three instructors bow their heads before. It was just the most haunting, fascinating, hilarious moment. And they're like, Jeff, do anything you want. You don't need to do jewelry. You can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. And you know, of course, that little mouse of armor went on display at the college, and people saw it, and there was a guy who came to, he was an art buyer for the Brofman family, says, oh, I'd like to buy this. I'm like, you're going to sell my first piece. So I sold my first piece, and other people said, well, I'd like one too. And, and I took this mouse before I sold it, and I went to an art gallery. I just took it to art galleries around Calgary. I don't know.
Just rolling with this mouse in your pocket?
What do you think? And there was a little gallery down in Kensington, Folio Gallery, Peter Duthie, one of the most wonderful human beings ever, and all he was selling was photography. I said, oh, you know what? We got all this floor space. Would you like to do an exhibition? I said, can I do it a year after I graduate? He said, yeah. So there I am, coming out of second year. I'm booked for my first professional commercial exhibition, and I've got 2 years to prepare. So spent all of my time really from that time on sort of trying to develop my work and get myself up to a standard. And it's kind of fun being naive, because you don't know what you don't know. And you can make, you know, they always say assumptions kind of a dumb thing, like never make assumptions. It was so interesting, because when I actually graduated from the college, I got no money, I got no shop, I got a show booked like for a year after I've graduated. I have to get a job, of all things, in a sign shop, like my father. My father was a sheet metal fabricator. He fabricated fancy signs. I had those skills because I used to work with them on weekends and doing that kind of stuff. So the only job I could get was in a sign shop. So there I am, working in a sign shop. And my dad said, okay, you can have the garage. So I've got this garage. I got a wood-burning stove.
No way.
I've got a little bench and a couple of hand tools. You know, I got nothing. And yeah, I'm going to build this exhibition, build this body of work. And then in the fall of, in September 1989, I had my first public commercial show at Folio Gallery. And the exhibition sold out.
No way. How many pieces were in that?
There was 10.
Okay.
There was 5 cats and 5 suits of mouse armor. And amazing. So I had famous battles represented cats versus mice. And this has always been kind of a theme for me right from the beginning anyway. And, you know, most amazingly, even there was one fellow that attended my opening that fateful evening of 1989, Lee Pacente. I'd love to say his name, because he now has the largest collection of my work.
No way.
He became my patron that night, and one of my best friends.
Awesome.
And he's been with me and followed me through my whole career. Hmm. And, you know, back in the 80s and into the 90s, there's not really such a thing as the internet. You're either doing exhibitions or you're not.
Yeah.
The first decade of my career was 110 exhibitions. So I was either in a, you know, doing a solo show or part of a group show every 6 weeks.
Wow.
For 10 years.
Wow.
And, you know, this job that I had at the sign shop, the other funny thing is that I lasted, you know, 1 year, 3 months, 6 hours, 27 seconds. And the funniest thing is that a lot of the other guys in the sign shop were also artists too, but they're all struggling to make a living. They all have their day jobs, and like me. And they knew, they could see the pressure I was under, because I was doing 40-hour weeks in the sign shop and 40 hours a week in my father's garage. As you can imagine how tired you get. Mm-hmm. I think I was beginning to lose my mind at the end. And that it was sort of interesting that the opening sold out show and fired all at the same time. So it was like, I'm done.
Wow.
I'm done. And wife at the time had an okay job, and she said, you know what, do this full time. Go for it. So I would like to think I retired from the workforce at the age of 26.
Mm. Was it devastating to get fired, or were you like,
no.
Okay, now's my, it was a relief? What was it?
Unemployable. I mean, I'm completely unemployable. There's no possible way I can hold a job. Not with what's going on in my mind. It's just not possible.
The level of creativity, the endless amount of ideas.
Yeah, these visions you have about what else can I do with this? I mean, the next exhibition after the Cat and Mouse Armor was about the corporate world. So I was making armored ties and briefcases and looking at the corporate world as feudal systems. I actually got a suit, started going into offices and spaces, and partly because it wasn't just cat and mouse armor. There was playing with other ideas. You know, I was making, eventually I have this other exhibition come up, and we'll talk about that. But for about 8 years of exploring different concepts. I did this thing called exoforms, which is looking at armor as an abstract conceptual thing, very Brancusi-esque. But the corporate stuff that I was doing, the armored ties and briefcases, connected me with the corporate world in Calgary.
Was that a conscious decision that you needed to make that connection?
You know, I just thought that looking at history, you know, the cut and line of a business suit actually has its origin in arming doublets, which were worn as armor or under armor as padding. Mm. The ties that we wear actually had their history in regimental scarves that were originally worn to protect and chafing from armor. And then they became tartans, and then they became school ties of the elites. So, and the things like handshaking were something straight off the battlefield. You offer your sword hand as a gesture of peace. And then things like freelance, in the old days, it meant you had a lance and you were for hire, you know. Something like blackmail used to literally mean they caught you, they took your chainmail, and they sold you and your armor back to your family. So these are, or you lost it in a tournament or whatever it was. So we have this corporate world that is it a democracy or is it a feudal system? Mm. I thought, you know, there's these towers, all these guys in armor performing all the actions of knights, doing the same thing. It's all for, you know, fighting over potatoes or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. We're doing this, but we're no longer conscious of it. So is there such a thing as corporate chivalry? And, you know, interesting, so by 94, I had all these relationships with corporations just because the odd executive was buying a tie and then, you know, they're whispering in your ear stuff. By 1994, or I should actually say 92, Richard White, lovely man, was the director of the Muttart Gallery here in Calgary, and he showed me the gallery, said, we've got 3 gallery spaces. We'd like to offer you one for a solo exhibition. I say, Richard, I want all 3 spaces. And I want to do a book. So one of the companies that I was related to through other projects and doing some commercial work was a company here in Calgary called Caro Design, Michael Dengelmeyer, and was the director. And I said, can you guys help me do a book? Can you find me a photographer? I want to do a whole bunch of new work, raise capital to finance the book and the traveling exhibition and all this. And Richard White's just, oh my God, this guy's out of his mind. But opening night, we had the exhibition called Articulation, 164 pieces, booked for a 2-year Western Canada tour. We finished the book. You know, the funny thing is we talk about social media today. You know, I finish a piece or a couple of pieces, do a social media post. What does it cost me? Just to kind of wind up into the future and come back, because I love being mm-hmm. that way. Last year, the most remarkable thing happened is my work was featured on the online National Geographic.
I remember this.
One post, 12.5 million views. It's just kind of mind-blowing what today's world is like. Back then, when I raised the capital to do my exhibition catalog/book, it cost $90,000 for 2,500 copies.
No way.
So what are you doing to raise that capital? You are crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
Right? So what are we pioneering here? And again, this is naive. I didn't know I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. I just thought we could. And, you know, but all that information is in the physical mail. You're sending out brochures. You have to physically meet people. You have to talk to people. You have to find sponsors. You have mm-hmm. to do all these sorts of things. And I didn't realize I was developing a set of skills that other artists don't have.
Yeah.
This idea of self-promotion, marketing oneself, is so important. And I think I learned that from Caro, because they said, you know, the pyramid, you know, your great ideas at the top, but marketing, Jeff, is the base of your pyramid. And if you can't professionally present yourself, talk about yourself, and make stuff happen, it's just not going to happen. Mm. And, you know, there's a kind of a twist in there too, even from this idea of ego, because some people think, like Jeff's ego. All he does is talk about himself. Well, it's my favorite subject. Or is that humility? Because I don't assume somebody's going to do that for me. I just can't. I'm not in that world. I don't think I'm so special that someone's going to do it for me. Mm. I have to do this myself, or it's not going to happen. And that maybe that's kind of coming out of this nothingness. If you don't build it, it's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And you know, I only had only maybe a couple of grants. I had a couple of grants at the very beginning of my career, and that was to also help cover the cost of that book at the time. Mm-hmm. But there's a moment where things start to really come together. So that exhibition tours. Its final big show is in Vancouver at the Canadian Museum of Craft.
And this is over a 2-year time period?
Yeah, so by 96.
Across the country?
Yeah, well, Western Canada.
Okay.
Museums and galleries and things. In 1996, the show opens up the Canadian Museum of Craft, again, the same body of work, but I've got the entire museum to myself. And I'm still being represented by commercial galleries. And my relationship with commercial galleries is again, cat and mouse relationship. Some of them have been really good for me, and some of them not so much. Part of the problem I have with commercial galleries is not the whole system itself, but the time it takes me to make something and the value of something. Doug Udell, one of the great Western Canadian art dealers, decided that he was going to take me on as one of his artists. So he only had 14 artists. I was going to be like 15.
Mm-hmm.
And he was extremely kind to me, extremely good mentor, and said, you know, Jeff, you're on probation. We're going to try this for 20 years, and then we're going to assess.
Sign me up.
So I had this weird idea that there I'd have my work at the Canadian Museum of Craft, which is craft. None of it is for sale. And then I was going to have the following weekend an opening at Doug Udell's Blue Chip Fine Art Gallery as art, everything for sale. So what are we talking about? Is this craft? Is this art? I don't know. But Doug was willing to risk, okay, we think it's art, Jeff, so let's show this work as art. And Doug had an opening that evening, a preview on the Friday night. I had the opening the first weekend, and I came back the second weekend to give a little talk at the Canadian Museum of Craft and then attend an opening on the Saturday at Doug's gallery. When I arrived at the Canadian Museum of Craft on that Friday night, it was standing room only. I had never seen anything like it. Like everyone, the who's who of Vancouver came out to see this crazy kid from Calgary and this exhibition that people are talking about. Mm. It was kind of like a mini blockbuster in its own way. And Doug was there and he said, oh, you know, I was about to give my talk. And Doug says, oh, I had my preview tonight and your body of work sold out tonight. Can we fix this for Saturday? At that time, I was making one of everything. I make one mouse of one cat. He said, can you have ever heard the word addition, Jeff? I'm like, what's that? He said, well, you know, you could take this mouse, you could make 5 or 6 of them or something. And I said, okay. So we went through the gallery. So okay, I'll make 2 more of those. I'll make 5 of those. And so Doug made his list. And the following day, Doug set up 67 commissions for me. So you have to ask yourself, at that moment, is that the beginning of something? Have I crossed the line? I mean, you're on CBC. I've got Peter Zosky interviewing me. You know, all these wonderful. Mm-hmm. You're attending an openings, and everybody's looking at you like you're, wow, we've all discovered somebody who's doing something really unusual, something mm-hmm. really special, and you start to think you're pretty special yourself.
Like, is it?
Why
is
wouldn't
it,
you?
Is it tough to manage that?
That's tough to manage, and this is the, you know, when does the hero's journey begin? The day they slay the dragon, or the weeks and years afterwards where they have to live with the implications of kind of the legend or the street cred that they have. And if you look at mythology, the hero can never return. There's a moment where there's going to be a different kind of decline, an internal one, from a different, because it's easy to like oneself on the way up. It's not so easy to like oneself when you start to discover you're only human and you're going to start to make some mistakes.
Hmm.
And the funny thing for me, now looking back at it, I guess being your own historian of things, what you would think was the beginning of my career, you know, I was going to be on the cover of art magazines. That was the end. That day was not the beginning. It was the end. And I didn't know it.
Like the exact opposite of what you thought.
It was the complete opposite of what I thought was happening to me. And the end, that there's one haunting story from all of this that I think that triggered maybe this beginning of this decline was just that, you know, it's just before Christmas, because the show was in September, but just before Christmas, Doug's got lots of clients. You know, I got a client that wants a suit of mouse armor for Christmas. Can you make a quick one? And then a couple of days before Christmas, can you blast one out, Jeff? Well, Superman, of course I can blast one out. I can work 20-hour days, whatever. So you blast this mouse out, you put it in a box, and you ship it to Vancouver. You know, it's Christmas, so you don't hear back till the new year. And Doug, I said to Doug, well, did the person get the mouse? Did they like it? Was it okay? And he said, yeah, and she died the next day. So a husband decided that one of my pieces was worthy of being a last gift for a dying wife. How do you come back from that? Like, you cannot, after that moment, it cannot be about yourself or your money or fame or any of these things. You cannot have anything leave the studio that ultimately is going to stand the test of time. That something you made today is going to be in somebody's life, and someday they're going to pass it down. And someday someone's going to either see it on the Antiques Roadshow or put a magnifying glass up to it. I needed this. I needed that lesson. That you cannot make something and have it leave the studio unless it's absolutely the best thing you could do on that day. You don't just blast things out, Jeff. You don't think you're Superman. You don't think that you can do anything. You have your limits, and you're only human, but also your ego can become its own trap if you're not careful. And, you know, when you think about mastery or Buddhism, all these sorts of things, for me, that was a hard lesson that I'm grateful that I did that for this person. But then you start to question, okay, could I have done better? So now you're having a certain amount of doubt that you need to have. So this is 96 into 97. And then, yeah, we get our first computer. We get our first internet. We get a whole bunch of other things happening. And sort of into this really weird thing. And then also I have all these incredible mentors coming into my life, and they're whispering things in my ears like, okay, Jeff, so, you know, how long does it take to make one of those? And what does the gallery get? And how long is it in the gallery? And what's your relationship? And then, you know, on like we had these, you know, an article would come out on Reddit or something early on and like 2 million views. And then you get all these people asking, well, can I get one of your pieces? And I'm like, well, Doug has established my market value. And I call it sort of the $10,000 problem. If I spend a month and a half building a $10,000 suit of cat armor, and it's in the gallery for 10 minutes before it sells, I understand galleries have overhead and they do promotion and things like that. And at the time, it was really important. That's the relationship, because the gallery has the only place where people could access your work. But now we have this new vehicle. People are asking to buy my work directly from me on an email at market value. So the business people are saying, well, Jeff, you're now in a relationship where it's this 50-50 because galleries take half of the value of the work. Wow. So you're getting $5,000 for your work. And the other thing is kind of a business-minded guy too. I incorporated, I had several employees. I tried to run the shop at such a level that I could supply the galleries. And I was working 70-hour weeks producing enough work. But when you have people working for you, mistakes happen, things go wrong. Yep. You have employees who aren't always in the best mood every day, and you're struggling. And I'm making less than $30,000 a year, but I'm producing $200,000 to $300,000 worth of art a year to keep this machine going. And just the stress of that. When when, and so just being able to carry this machine, there's a different business model has to come into play. Now we have to sell on the internet, and we got to get out of the gallery scene.
Yeah.
And I got to get rid of my employees, because I can produce, if I could produce $100,000 worth of work by myself, and get all of the money, this is a very different game. And so are we pioneering now the idea of sort of the independent visual artist?
Which, it's early then, right?
Like that's right.
Mid-90s?
We have the independent music scene. Are we entering into something, we don't know what's coming, we don't know what it is, but our instincts are telling us, this looks like this makes more sense. Mm-hmm. But so the sad thing is, because, you know, when we produce, at that time we produce work on spec. You know, you build a piece, and like my last name's De Boer, which means the farmer. So you think about it. Well, my crop doesn't sell in the fall, I'm going to lose the farm. And this was happening all the time. Mm. If I build a body of work and it goes into the gallery and it doesn't sell, now what? You're stuck with all this stuff. You've taken all the risk. And so the demise or the end of my time in supposedly the art world is when, you know, one gallery person says, "You're done, Jeff." I said, we can't handle you anymore. Because I put a cat in their gallery and said, it's a race now to see who can sell it first. It's on spec. You have it in your gallery, you can sell it. But if I get an order online for this cat, I'm pulling it.
Mm.
But they wanted all my client lists. They wanted me to commit to the gallery, which makes sense to them. But I couldn't do that because there was this other opportunity, this other opening. I'm sort of like, okay. The person, she said, "You'll never be on the cover of an art magazine, Jeff. It's over. You're done." "Oh, okay, well, we'll try it." And he said, "I wish you well. Come and get all your stuff. But your reputation in the gallery world is going to be trash from here on in."
Hmm.
I didn't ever get that from Doug Adell. Doug was fabulous. He was, you know, "Jeff, we'll just do whatever you want." Like, Doug was so good. I would have loved to have done an exhibition with him again, but I just could never produce surplus after that. So then I went from on spec to now commission. So where do you go with that? Like, do you risk a piece or do you put money in the bank and then go to work? Well, I can tell you which one makes much more sense. So that I pursued that. But then there's this other niggly thing that's bugging you, is I'm only ever going to be the cat and mouse armor guy and all these other things. I've got to try and do large public work too.
Hmm.
So, just recently my tin toy airplanes came out of the airport.
I saw that.
That was one of my first really big breakthrough projects.
Hmm.
So, what's interesting with that project is, again, that was private sector. That's the airport authority as their own thing. They're not a public. It's not public art stuff. This is public in the public, but it's private sector stuff.
Yep.
I got that first commission, and I was able to produce this crazy big piece to the quality that I, you know, sort of giant jewelry. The question is, was this giant tin toy a sculpture? Well, you know, we had this context is everything in the world. You have an airport. You can't put sharks and formaldehyde in airports. Just between you and me, that high-end spectrum of the art world isn't appropriate in a space where people are maybe afraid to get on airplanes. They had a requirement. They said they wanted, you know, it to be for young and old. They wanted about the history of aviation. They wanted it to be colorful. And the competition I was in with the other artists at that time, interestingly, they were producing their art. Their style, their art had nothing to do with airports, but they might paint a little airplane in the corner and say, "You see, there we go." And they had these wonderful artist statements. Where I came out of the jewelry department, which was not just conceptual, but also a world of design. So as a designer, you first thing you do is you listen. What do you want? So am I going to build something that's about me? Or am I going to try to build something from a design perspective? And don't forget, I love airplanes, so I love the theme. I'm going to try to create the craziest, wildest, biggest, giganticest, wild tin toys I can, because it's young and old, tin toys for old people, toys for young people, colorful, and it's going to be about airplanes from the history of Alberta, all as tin toys. And they're going to be kinetic, big wind-up tin toys, and they're going to be beautifully engineered, and they're going to run, and they're going to all this stuff. No pressure, Jeff, right?
It's a swing.
And I got the job, and we were able to produce that, but to produce that, you have to go into engineering, you've got to go and work in big fabrication shops, and you're starting to build a different kind of network again. And, you know, interestingly, my whole career, for the most part, has been in the private sector. Mm-hmm. That is to say, I never need to apply for grants. I've completely been able to finance everything through my work and develop a skill set that leaves me with things like project management, marketing, being able to do finance. These are skills that are not conventionally or traditionally taught in universities. You know, I always laugh because I had this opportunity to give my ill-fated lecture at the university one day. You know, we're going to have Jeff DeBoer come in. Well, they might not ever have him come back if he says what he's doing. So he has to say.
Somebody to do the research.
And so count my own experience or my ideas about how to survive and succeed in the art world are so counter to the conventions of the academic world. And I'd like to use a couple of analogies here because it'll really help set this up. You know, it's sort of like saying, you know, Wayne Gretzky. Yeah, like you go back to hockey players again. I love my hockey players. You can't play in the NHL until you have a degree. You know, if you had hockey theory and coaching education, you'd be such better hockey player in the NHL. It's almost the assumption that people make that if I go to university and I get this amazing education, which it will be an amazing education. Absolutely. The question in my world is that what you need? You know, so we go back to Leonardo da Vinci here, the beginning. He never went to university. He was a man, he came out of the guilds. He wasn't a man of letters. He worked for a guild master back in the Renaissance when if you were a rich Medici and you want a nice house and paintings and furniture and stuff, you don't. There's no Walmart. You go to a guild master who has all of these artisans with all these varieties of different skills, and they pull it all together for you. They do the architecture, the sculpture, the painting. Which artist do you want? And the young uprising artists who have talent, you know, become the stars of the guild, and eventually they become their own masters because they make their own connections with their own Medicis and eventually run their own guilds. And there's a whole system that worked. You know, my joke is, you know, back in the Renaissance, you know, before Canada Council, they seemed to produce a couple of okay things. So how did that work? So my lecture to students at the art colleges and in universities is there's 24 things you need to know in the real world to really be able to succeed. And if you know 22 of them, you may still succeed. If you know 20 of them, you still might succeed. If you're down to 18, it's getting a little iffy. University does an amazing job of teaching three.
What's the reaction when you say that?
Not likely to get a tenured position at the university. Because what I'm talking about sort of shakes up the whole business model. And you know, for years, I've worked with emerging artists, some of them from universities, and I'll say, you know what, that university education is fantastic. It's so much easier to talk about concept and ideas and all this sort of stuff, and I've worked with others that have none of that. And they get that slowly through osmosis or whatever, through conversation and hanging out with artists that have that anyway. But what really matters in the NHL is what's making the game exciting. That's what really matters at the end of the day. Who's putting that puck in the net in a triple overtime with style? And you don't see a lot of hockey coaches out there on the ice trying to put that puck in the ice. They've got star players, people who have a certain knack, a talent, something, a drive that nobody else has. To be quite honest, you just can't learn that anywhere. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing for music. You know, how many, I don't know if Dolly Parton needed to go to any university to become Dolly Parton. Mm-hmm. Kind of doubt it. Dolly Parton needed to go through the process of in the real world on that stage performing with her life experiences from the heart, writing about the things that mattered to her because she had a talent and a drive. And would an education be a waste of her time is the big question. Probably. Yeah. It's a waste of time. You only got so much life. You only produce so much stuff. So, you know, and Wayne Gretzky reportedly wasn't a great coach in the end either. So he can't explain what he does. He just does it. He just is this thing. Mm-hmm. So this in any art form, you know, if you really think about it, if a person with talent gains access to skills and opportunities, they can develop a successful career in the arts. This is my theory. You want to have a concept. So, I mean, my, you know, talk about concept, you know, when I was being educated, and even to this day, and maybe even more so this day, you know, how do we define success from educated people who come out of universities? The big success is certainly getting a tenured position as an instructor. That's the big success. Mm-hmm. Certainly producing the kind of you know, really great conceptual work that gets funded by Canada Council. And again, we can start to get into conspiracies here, but so there's a culture around success, you know, and of course selling your work and being represented by commercial galleries is another thing. These are the things that they teach. So we taught how to write grants, how to schmooze our way into a commercial gallery, which is going to take half of everything we do for the rest of our lives. Mm-hmm. Maybe that works for painters. You can pump out a $1,000 painting a day. No big deal. Doesn't work for cat armor. But anyway. So there's an incentive within the universities and in the culture to focus on the three critical things. And certainly that is, you know, again, your arts education, your conceptual thinking, your ability to write for grants or teach or all these sorts of things. And those are all, if you think about the art world like hockey, we need coaches, we need administrators, we need historians, we need Zamboni maintenance people. Mm-hmm. We need all that. Mm-hmm. Degrees create all of those pieces for that market. But again, who's on the ice is always my fundamental question. So when I graduated from ACAD, my wife and I said, how are we going to define success? Is it, and of course, I had to be the guy to say this, but I said, is it going to be how many grants I receive over my career or how much taxes I pay? Why don't I become the greatest supporter of Canada Council by contributing my tax dollars to support other artists but never draw a penny out of it? Mm-hmm. Now that's, to me, that's going back into this sort of warrior culture thing where, you know, one of my favorite movies is The Seven Samurai or Yojimbo. Where this vision, you're this lone samurai in this hostile world trying to save villages because it's what you do. And self-reliant, saving you're protecting yourself. You know, one of the concepts of chivalry is self-reliance. You know, to be a knight, you have to be able to afford a horse, armor, training. You have to be good at business to be able to support the trappings of chivalry. Mm-hmm. Right, you can put a horse, you can put a peasant in armor, put them on a horse, and march them down a parade. But they can't; they're not a knight. They haven't. There's a financial cost. There's a discipline requirement. There's a bunch of things that you learn in martial arts. As I said, we started to connect all the pieces. Mm-hmm. But that sort of that focus and discipline of martial arts applied to art career, and then mentorship with people like business people and accountants and others who say, this is how you can structure a world that is self-reliant and sustainable for you. Mm. Everybody's different. As soon as you start producing things that are commercially viable, and I was very lucky, I think I won the idea lottery. Go figure, mouse armor is commercially viable.
Who knew?
Who thought? Like one of the most unusual occupations on earth. But then there'll be a class of people, maybe at the academic level, that can't get past that. And because they have no experience with it, they don't know how to relate to it. They don't know how to, they couldn't teach it because they, that's not their world. You know, and I'd like to use another, you know, if you want to go down another conspiracy path here, because I've said this many, many times. I'd like to use North Korea as a little bit of an analogy. You know, if you're born in North Korea and your family, your parents are part of the elites of North Korea, you're gonna have a nice house, great education, healthcare, everything's good. But you're gonna live in a world that you're told is a certain way and operates and is successful. The definition of success in that world is gonna be your universe. You're not gonna know any better than this. You're gonna believe this 100%. There's no reason for you to ever argue against it, because anybody that ever does, where are they? What happens to them? You could say that the similar kind of ideas or culture may even exist at a university level. If I wanna be tenured, look at the current tenure, look at the things they believe in, the conversations, the things they talk about. If I'm counter culture to that, I don't know if I'm gonna get tenure. And yet tenure is supposed to be the opportunity to be all those things. And yet it's over time, these things have transformed in a way that people have to play the game if they wanna be successful. Mm. And you know, and I don't blame anyone. I mean, you get a dental plan, you get benefits. By the way, Yojimbo doesn't have a dental plan or benefits, right? There's like, I'm trying to think of the reasons why you want to walk this path. It's sometimes it's kind of hard to find good reasons. Mm-hmm. So, but you're going to, you know, in even about what is art, you know, the highest level of art, we art is this spectrum. So we have on one end, you know, the sort of the academic challenging art, not sellable, or whatever, and I always like to pick on Damien Hirst or whatever, or someone with shock art, you know, sharks and formaldehyde, you know. A, it's toxic, even to stand in front of it. You can't put it in airports. But it's an important work somehow. Okay, fine. On the other end, we have McDonald's Happy Meals plastic toys. Both are created by artists, believe it or not. And everything from that plastic toy up to sharks and formaldehyde, there's a spectrum of things. And there's a slider. You know, at the highest level, maybe you are the super rock star and somebody's going to give you $10 million for every little thing you do. And that's the dream. Good for you. On the other end, you're a designer working in a firm and you're getting, you know, a decent paycheck designing McDonald's Happy Meal toys. You have the old ladies doing their landscape paintings somewhere on this spectrum, and maybe they sell them at craft fairs and they're making a living, and that's good. But above that, where do we get into this sort of weird zone, somewhere between sort of this conceptual work and this some more of commercial thing? You know, so the, you know, we look at a, use the perfect example, a suit of mouse armor. You know, we get, sometimes you get, on social media, you get all kinds of interesting comments, especially when this National Geographic article came out. It was an interesting week, let's just say. Mm-hmm. Because I was 12 hours a day looking through comments for a week straight.
Wow.
Because the people of National Geographic said, Jeff, could you please respond to people? It'd be really nice if you did that. Well, this is a full-time job for a week, but you gain all kinds of really interesting insights when you, because some, not all people are nice. Some people are kind of trollish, you know. Some, yeah. I always like the, I'm not sure if it's a positive or negative, it's just the one word, why? Why?
Why not?
You know, one person says, oh, he sits there and he talks about his stuff and all he's making is toys. Well, you know what? If you think it's a toy, then let's go there. It's a pretty neat toy, especially to a five-year-old. Suit of armor is like a toy, and I get that. Some people say, oh, it's just fantasy stuff. Well, you know what? If you think a suit of mouse armor is fantasy, I'm good with that. Let's go there too. That's for you. Mm-hmm. You know, some people think this is like the most crazy kinetic, you know, wearable art for a mouse I've ever seen. Well, that's a little higher. I'll take that cookie. Cool. That's a good one. Mm-hmm. You know, and some people are like, this is masterful work of art. Well, I'm thrilled. Mm. So, you know, you start to ask yourself, okay, well, maybe someday I should do an exhibition again. I haven't exhibited since like 2000, so it's been a little while.
A couple years.
You know, and I had my breakdown with the art world. I've had this sort of epiphany that maybe I don't belong in the art world. I've had, maybe I am this mouse artisan in this world of conceptual cats, which is kind of fun. I mean, just to back up a bit again, you know, this spring, the AU Arts so lovingly and thoughtfully decided to give me an honorary master's degree. So, you know, and my acceptance speech, you know, I had to go away and think about this because I've said some pretty disparaging things to these cats. And, you know, my acceptance speech really was, so I do have this cat-mouse relationship with you and I'm honored. And, you know, but again, this accepting this from you is, again, it's like a mouse being told by the cats you're invited to be our special guest of honor for dinner. In my world, that can go two ways. There will be some in the audience who will understand and instructors and champion what I'm trying to say. And there are others that would be quite intimidated by what I'm trying to say and where I'm trying to go. So if I was going to do an exhibition again, would I want to be in the context of the art world or would I want to be in another context? And I think that there's another context that exists that's been obvious to me my whole life. And I, you know, I think about it, it all makes sense. You know, I've when I travel around the world, whenever I get to have a vacation, my thing is to go to all the great museums of the world and see the artifacts left behind by others. And, you know, for me, walking through the Victoria and Albert Museum is not like everybody else's experience because my brain will disassemble and reassemble every object in that room, in every gallery. I take everything apart and put it back together again. I'm blown away by what I see, but I'm exhausted within a few hours. Like I need to take a break, guys, because my brain is having the time of its life, but it's in overtime. The best moment with traveling again, remember Lee, my favorite, Lee Pacente, he invited my wife and I to do a tour of Egypt with him because he worked in Tunisia for a while. And we'll go for dinner in Tunisia, then we'll take a trip to Egypt. Okay, that sounds like a plan. But we're in the Cairo Museum, and I'm looking at Tutankhamun's golden mask. And Lee, to this day, will never forget that moment because I am taking the thing apart in a way that probably most don't. Everybody's amazed and blown away by it, but I'm like, look at this and look at that. And holy mackerel, that's kind of rough on the inside and this, that. But pulling away from that and having a few years to think about it, I've sort of realized that, you know, we look at this piece. This is my helmet for Lee. He's commissioned this piece. It's inspired by the Sutton Hoo ship burial, which was in the year 620. Between the year 620 and 625, King Redwald had the good fortune of passing away, and they buried him in Sutton Hoo, England, a ship burial, one of the greatest archaeological finds of Anglo-Saxon art and artifacts. And it was the British King Tut's tomb. I say this piece is Sutton Hoo inspired because to attempt to do the artisanship and craftsmanship of that level from the Sutton Hoo ship burial is very intimidating. But to this day on social media, I have like the conservator of the Sutton Hoo Museum following me. So the question is, you know, and I've done this before with other pieces where clients will say, well, my cat passed away. Here's what the cat was like. Could you make a suit of armor in a style that suits the personality of my cat? So let's just say this helmet was the same thing. So what is this any different than Tutankhamun's golden mask? Is it not for a deceased god? Is it, you know, is it in memory of, is it now an artifact? And will I ever see it again? So the artisans that made Tutankhamun's golden death mask, there must have been a day when it's in the shop, it's finished, and all their friends come over for a beer, and they drank beer, and they kind of rolled in it for a second, and had conversations, not unlike the conversations I would have in my shop when my friends come over to see something we finished before it goes in a crate, gets shipped off to somewhere in the world, and I'm never going to see it again either. And I can, just using my imagination, there's somebody in the room like me who worked on the thing, and he doesn't really believe in this Egyptian religion stuff so much. he's just really like, wow, we had a pharaoh as a patron. I had 15 generations of artisans before me handing down their skills to me to get me to a point where I could produce something like this. And you know, it was in the doing. Who cares if it's going in a tomb? But you know what? 1,000 years from now, when they open this tomb, this is going to fry somebody's noodle. That's where I want to be. I want to be the guy that's making a couple of things in my lifetime. They're going to go on this journey, and in a few years, they're going to fry people's noodles. Like, the archaeology editor and writer of National Geographic, when she contacted me, she didn't do it because I promoted myself or sent her an email or found her out or hunted her down. She came across my work on her own. And without prompt or anything, approached me and asked me if I would be interested in doing an article. And then she invited me for an hour and a half interview. And in that hour and a half interview, I asked her to tell me, what do you think? Because this is what really matters. And she said the thing that I've been hoping somebody would say and the thing I've been thinking my whole life is, 500 years from now, this stuff gets pretty funny. I'm playing a super long game. Like, maybe it's not the greatest art in some people's minds today, but I guarantee you the suit of mouse armor is built to last. It will be passed down through generations. If you take one of these to the scrapyard, you're going to get 10 cents for it. There's no value in destroying one. They're kind of armored against time itself. And she said, you know, I would love to be the archaeologist 500 years from now, pulling open a drawer and finding your stuff and then having to write about it with no idea who, that you existed or whatever it was. Wouldn't that be just the optimal thing? Well, that's the exhibition I wanted to have. Let's put on an exhibition of my work as if it's 500 years from now.
Cool.
Let's not do this in an art gallery. Let's do this in a museum. That would be fun. And you know what? Let's fill out all of the other bits and pieces of history to go with this work too. You know, there's got to be a couple, frescoes we can do or whatever around this universe of this relationship, this world of cats and mice. I think that would be really fun to explore. What is that relationship? You know, is it the history? You know, I would love to do Tutankhamun. Wouldn't it be fun to do Tutankhamun's as a sphinx cat in that scale, in gold, as an archaeological reproduction piece? And what's it worth? Are we now getting into Damien Hirst territory? But the just the sort of the impact of something like that sitting in a showcase, so iconic, it's been on the cover of National Geographic, to produce a piece like that in the context of an exhibition, when you walk in, you don't know if this is real or not. Are we creating reality? Is that where things start to become a little bit more conceptual? Are we having a little more fun? Would it be fun to explore a gift shop? That would be fun. I have a friend in California. I love name dropping, but he's Dave Goldberg, and he's a Disney Imagineer. More so, he's now gone into Disney's. He actually recently got some work. He's now working in the Disney R&D department, which is like godlike status for anybody who's ever wanted to have a career doing something creative and have infinite resources. But he's also one of the world's best model makers. He wants to work with me and do a series of plastic model kits of mice. Wouldn't it be fun to go to an exhibition and anybody could go home with one of my pieces and build their own and explore and have fun with that? What I like about the idea of museum is it has a much more open, in my mind, context again. Go back into context. Like when you walk onto the floor of an art gallery, there's a certain assumption I think you make that you're expecting to see art. I like museum because if that guy that thinks my work is just toys sees the best toy exhibition he's ever seen, I'll take that. That's what a museum offers. If somebody wants to come in there and debate that this is some great high conceptual piece and maybe we can write something about that, fine. But museums, in my mind, are much more open to young and old. We're getting, people with arts educations or not, people who are going to love it or hate it, people who are going to be inspired by it. And the thing is that going back to that Tutankhamun golden mask, the real one, those artisans passed down their skills through time. And I encountered those skills literally at our college. They have literally been passed down artisan to artisan through time. And I encountered those skills. And you get cat armor helmets that are not that far off. You know, when you think about time bouncing and so what to do with my life, wouldn't it be lovely to keep making this stuff? And if you follow me on social media, you'll see I keep talking about and sharing how it's done. I'm not worried about somebody ripping me off. The funniest part is, like, National Geographic, you know, basically the article says the first, best, and only, which happens to be owned by Disney, pretty good for my copyright at this point. I don't have to worry about that. You know, I would like to spend my career, the rest of my career, producing the best things I can and sharing how it's done to as many people as I can. So that others, if they want to start taking on mouse armor at some point in the future, starting with model kits, why not? It doesn't have to be, my own sacred special thing. We already know it is. I don't have to prove that ever again. So there's a sense of relief and freedom that you're getting from being able to actually completely let go. It doesn't matter.
To get to that point was just years of experiences, and just gets you confidence is there to just let it go.
Yeah, maybe that's the beginning of that mastery thing I've been seeking. You know, the nice thing about having done a lot of big, large public works, I don't have to prove that to myself ever again, you know? You know, recently I just built a new studio behind my home. It's purpose-built, not for the big stuff anymore, not for industrial stuff. It's so that I can crank out the best small-scale pieces I'm ever going to make. So this is going to be, this has to be the magic couple of decades for me, if I survive.
Do you look at it with that kind of, like, time frame? Do you put, like, this is, you know, a couple more decades in the making?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I'm 60 now. It's kind of weird in its own sense. You know, if it takes me 6 years to build an exhibition, you're going to be 65. And if it tours for 5 years, it's 70. So you're looking at, you know, this is kind of like coming onto the last great, this is the last great battle, the last big dragon. I like that. You know, again, it's...
fits.
It fits. You know, what you're going to leave behind, you're getting into a different time period. Like, you're not trying to get somewhere anymore. You're trying to get what you've got and go and run with it as best you can now. You know, it's you're much more relaxed. You certainly don't mind taking the time. So this should be the time you're going to make the best things you're ever going to make. Hopefully say the best things you're ever going to say. You know, leave behind, how do you want to be remembered? All these sorts of things. Is there a legacy piece here?
I was just going to ask you that.
You know, would it be possible to, you know, like I've mentioned that I've mentored emerging artists. You know, they are probably up to 20 now. And again, some of them from, you know, university and some of them not. And being able to pass on some of those 21 other skills or give them access to resources. My favorite, a Padawan, is that a great word? Wife tells me there's no, it's not a real word, Jeff. It's a made up word. Well, it sounds better than apprentice. I have Andrew Holloway, who was one of... There was a time when I was teaching. That's past. I was teaching at the AU Arts for a while. Andrew Holloway became my best friend and one of my favorite students, and he's Indigenous. And he and I have done a couple of public works together in the private sector that have his work, their Indigenous works. So I think it's fun because you can have an Indigenous guy who's got this amazing design sense and ability, and you've got this Dutch guy who's got this amazing fabrication capability and industry, and we can come together and we can do this thing together that neither of us could do. And I hope one day he and I will get together and we'll do an Indigenous mouse. That's my dream, is that he and I will produce a couple Indigenous warrior mice Wouldn't it be lovely if after that, Andrew could continue producing those on his own if he wants?
Yeah.
As coming through this world and then into his own world.
Yep.
But because the mouse armor has always given me this opportunity to explore cultures, you know, we have the samurai mouse here. You know, I get to immerse myself in Japanese design, armor, culture through working on that piece.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have the Viking mouse. Well, everybody loves a good Viking and all the amazing design work and metalwork. I get to touch their world and their history through building a piece like that. Then we have this one, which is the Maratha Hussar, which is two cultures together. Our mayor, Jyoti Gondek, asked me if I could make a piece for her and her husband, and she's from India and her husband's from Poland. Mm. So the Maratha Hussar, so it's the Maratha Empire, 16th century, and the Winged Hussars, or I should say 17th century, both of them. So these are two cultures together, cultural fusion pieces.
Mm.
So, you know, when Andrew comes into the picture, we looking at indigenous culture, you know, as a Dutch guy, all I can do is appropriate. Where does the word authenticity come into the play?
Mm.
It's authentic for me to be the first and only doing something in exploring cultures through a medium, through absolute appreciation, not appropriation. But when we get into the sort of the indigenous world, because Andrew is there, why do that? Andrew, you do it. Mm. Let's do it together.
Mm.
And let's explore this together and let me learn from you and let you learn from me.
Yep.
We can each be, in our own way, spirit guides to each other through a process and come out the other end different.
Mm.
And produce something that is absolutely authentic, one of a kind, special. And that seems to me to be the real magic in all of this. You know, it's amazing to me how mouse armor can be all these things and open all these doors. Like I won the lottery. I really did.
Mm-hmm.
And it's given me opportunities, you know, to explore large public pieces and get introduced to all kinds of mentors. And, you know, with that, I was doing well before, but the National Geographic article, I now have collectors all over the world. There's never going to be a moment where I'm going to be short of work for the rest of my life. That's not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about trying to find work. It's now trying to decide what's worth doing from here on in.
Mm.
You know,
it's an interesting spot to be.
It's an interesting spot to be. A life of absolute gratitude. And very few people know, you know, then here's this guy working. It's sort of funny because I started my parents' garage and I've now returned to a garage. You know,
full circle.
It's exactly the same square footprint.
No way.
You know, awesome. Or same square footage.
Yep.
And I love that you've come back full circle and, you know, it's sort of like, again, getting back to the mythology, has the hero returned? Well, he's returned to, yeah, in a sense, to his own village again, but what a village, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. your research around history, just mm-hmm. this common thread for your,
yeah,
just it's just been there
mm-hmm.
from, like you said, my whole young age.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. Yeah, and, you know, amateur, you know, archaeologist, historian, or whatever mm-hmm. you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, like I said, you know, when you're doing something like a Sutton Hoo cat, you're looking at all that Sutton Hoo jewelry and you're just like, oh my God, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know. If I can emulate and catch the feel of it, that would be great. Yep. But if I tried to reproduce it, it's not a Jeff DeBoer anymore.
Mm.
And we're getting back into that, am I making just a model? We can never do that again. You know, you have to take anything and you have to twist it or you have to somehow get it into your blood where it's part of you. That's the artisan speaking,
yep.
you know?
Yep.
And I think that, you know, for anybody who wants to get into a creative field, you know, there's an amazing arts education. Never forget that those three things that they're teaching at the university are absolutely critical, especially if you want to really do some weird things. But talent is going to be the major thing that's mm-hmm. going to be the real decider and how hard you want to work.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that willingness to change yourself. I've seen the many years of working with other artists and saying, well, look at your work. ask yourself, would you buy this? So how is it you're expecting others to buy it?
Mm-hmm.
How are you hoping somebody's going to buy it? You're hoping that this is going to sell. You really hope. And you're wondering why it's not selling.
Mm-hmm.
So is there something you could do with this? Either make it nicer quality, whatever, upgrade it somehow,
yep.
change it somehow, give it a little bit more of a finish and a commercial potential, and is there a market for it? Have you thought about that? So when you ask people that question, the very often people do go deer in headlights. It's like saying, well, how's your grasp of accounting today? Those 24 things, you don't need to be able to do them all, but you have to have access to them. Mm. And some of them you have to change yourself to make it work.
Mm.
And you have to be honest with yourself. Is my work good enough? I mean, nice thing about the NHL is they have scouts who will say, it's not going to happen, kid.
Yeah.
We don't have instructors at universities ever telling anyone, it's not going to happen. Is that really what you want? Well, here's this alternative. You know, kind of going back to Korea again, this North Korean thing, maybe I got distracted. But those people who live in Korea, there's no incentive for them, as I said, to speak against the system.
Mm.
So they will spend all their time defending that system. So often in arts education, the question is are we dealing with people who are benefiting from defending a system that ultimately does not create an exciting artist in the field? Because if you want to be an exciting artist in the field, maybe guilds are where you need to go. Maybe guilds are what we need to create again.
Mm.
I would love to see something like a guild start up in Calgary again, a place where you have glass blowing studios, fabrication shops, workshops, you know, jewelry studios. Artists graduate from universities, and where do they go? They become security guards or they serve coffee. Because they just don't have their parents' garage and mouse armor as a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
But what if you, as a glassblower, you could have access to a glassblowing hot shop? Because the thing that kills glassblowers is the cost of running a shop. But you could make some work. Maybe there's a gallery there, all these sorts of things. You see places like this in Europe, and they're actually tourist attractions. You know, people walk along the galleries, and there's all these artists working. You know, if Calgary wants to be an innovation city, what if that place also was a place where startup companies could go and from an industrial design perspective and have access to CNC machines, laser cutting machines? What if glass blowers have access to CNC machines and laser cutting machines and they can start putting things together? Mm-hmm. What if people developing new products need a piece of glass one day in a special shape and the glass person can make that for them? What if there was a place where all Calgarians, like a public utility, you know, we have, I don't know how much a rec center costs. And what's its purpose?
Mm-hmm.
Health in a community. You know, how much does the Olympic bobsled track cost? How much does it cost to put a couple bobsledders on the pedestal? No, the podium, I should say. How much?
Mm-hmm.
What if we had a public utility facility in Calgary that wasn't about exercise or putting people in Olympics? What was about supporting every emerging physical artist in the city, a place like a library of equipment, tools, where there are technicians? What if public art projects that could be run through there too? So you ensure they're built correctly, quality,
mm-hmm.
and every artist that works on those projects gets mentored through every process from beginning to end, so that we churn out Olympic class artists in the city. One of the reasons why artists in Calgary do not compete with international artists in public art competitions is because they've never had that kind of support. And they're competing against people who have.
Mm-hmm.
To use the Olympic analogy, you know, let's say it's bobsled. You know, the Europeans are sending someone who's been trained their whole life and has the world-class equipment. And we're pulling some kid out of 7-Eleven because he likes tobogganing and say, go get him.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
From a training perspective. We do great arts education about the subject of art. We have people who are way more knowledgeable about art than I'll ever be, but they can't make mouse armor. So where is the training and skills? And I was lucky that the Jewry department offered me those skills and enough of that art thinking as a balance to turn out a Jeff DeBoer. Will we ever turn out another one in this city? I don't know. You know?
Yeah.
The irony, and it's always not to put down the sculpture department because they have their own culture and their own ways, but they were not a craft-friendly, understanding department. So the irony for me was, you know, I graduated out of the Jewry department making sculpture, getting straight A's. My question is, what do you think my chances are for good grades were if I tried to come out of the sculpture department making jewelry? And there's sort of, for me, is sort of the center of the difference between the cats and the mice in this world. The cats, it works for them. They get all the Canada Council funding and tenured teaching positions, and they're represented by commercial galleries, and that's what they teach and they understand. But they cannot have this conversation with me until they've lived it for a while. So when you drop your, you know, just try it, and it's frightening. And we think about, you know, we talk about artists taking risks, and we use that term a lot. Like, yep, this is a very risky artist. Well, also their work is not sellable, but it's also risky, and I get that, and it's wonderful art and all that kind of stuff. Recently, I was sitting in on a panel of two kinds of artists. Artists that are supported by grants and artists that are private sector. And the two, when you think about risk, so the ones that are supported by grants, we would argue, are the ones that are taking the more artistic conceptual risks. So that's where they're risk takers.
Yeah.
The commercial private sector artists are taking less artistic risks because they need to make a living from their work. So we'd say maybe their work is a little bit more conservative. So one's more risky, one's more conservative. So that'll always be the academic argument against the one versus the other. However, the private sector artists don't want to apply for grants because they don't want the not getting of a grant to prevent them from doing the thing that they want to do. That's interesting. They would rather raise capital, take out loans, sell their house to do this thing they want to do, whether it's success or not, because the time it takes to write a grant, or if they don't get a grant, they have to change their idea. So let's just say the only way I could produce mouse armor was through Canada Council. But what if somebody in Canada Council doesn't like mouse armor? Then I got to apply for a grant for something other than mouse armor if I want to get funding. Am I Jeff DeBoer anymore? Or am I just a technician to an artist that is on the Canada Council? Who's deciding what's art in Canada? Me or a jury? So if I don't get my grant, just to repeat myself, I have to present a kind of art that will get one. And the question is, whose art is that anymore? So this is my thing. Then on the other side, we have the granted artist saying, they say, well, if you guys got together and did this thing, it'd be pretty interesting if you guys did this. They say, oh, we would only do that if we got a grant. So what they're saying is they're risk averse unless they're supported by a grant, which is a conservative notion to me. So they're both risky and conservative in different ways.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that one is better or more right than the other. They're just very different. The question is do you want to be one or the other or somewhere in between? Can you survive exclusively off of your work? And when I asked that question, can I make a living from my work, I knew there would be implications. There is going to be implications. Things are going to have to be of a certain quality, that have a certain commercial standard. Is that interfering with my work? Or is my work all about that? I don't know. You know, I'm not sure. I know that I love what I do. And I get to get away with it. I'm lucky I have something that I can sell. So it's easy for me to say. But for others trying to emerge into the art fields, you know, you see, we have these public art fairs and things like that. You see a lot of little booths and people selling their work at this level, and it's pretty successful, and I think they're having fun. You know, maybe that's where it should be too. The thing is that one of the problems we have in the marketplace is that because a lot of work is funded by grants and things like that, people think that artists, they do it for fun, or that because they're supported somehow, they don't deserve fair compensation for their work. Hmm. If they're represented by galleries, they assume that they could sell their work for half because that's all they're getting anyway. So it's very difficult for artists to promote and develop an economy around their work where they're defending their values. The reason why I like to mentor and develop my own competition, if you want to call it, you need more artists out there engaging with the public and with patrons to educate them so that they understand and appreciate the value of what all artists do. Mm. Everybody wins when everybody's doing that. But when you have artists that are willing, you know, when you have people who think, well, I'll just offer them $50 because they're desperate. Well, yeah, they're going to take $50 because they're desperate. And now that becomes the standard.
Yeah.
You know, I remember I used to put work in silent auctions to support charities. Mm-hmm. But what was really happening is people had spent their $100 to get a ticket so that they could spend 20% of the value of my work to get a piece. Mm. So I'm not helping the charity, and they're depreciating 20 years of struggle in one evening for me. Mm. I can't play that game.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I can't do that. That's terrible.
Yeah.
Like, if I put a piece in a public auction, I don't care if I get any. I want all the money to go to the charity, but I want the piece to sell for market value or over, mm-hmm. minimum, or I want it back. Mm-hmm. Because it's not about the charity. My value is being completely depreciated because the people hosting the event have no incentive to protect you. Mm-hmm. They just want to get a quick buck for their charity.
Yeah.
So when you think about the way things have happened in the past and the way things could happen in the future, we could have an economy in Calgary that, like, we had a guild-like place where people were trained to produce quality work, yeah. and defend values and become good enough to not just win competitions here but go overseas and start winning them over there, mm. where you would have innovative companies looking to Calgary and coming to a place where they can do startups and, yeah. work together in a collaborative place with artists, and artists can get exposed to industry and learn how to apply that to their work. Mm-hmm. You know, I always laugh. There was a little startup company in the United States. I don't know if you've heard of it anyway, but they thought they could do an art form that was pretty commercial, but they could take it to a whole new standard. And so they started this thing up, and they brought in a bunch of pretty creative artists, and they started producing some pretty good stuff, and they actually became quite successful. What's that company called? Disney.
Wait.
You have to have a visionary who sees an art form and wants to take it to someplace.
Yep.
There are lots of artists who are not visionaries, who make excellent technicians. I have lovely technicians who can work for me too. And they're not me. They're not the, you know, they're not the front man for the band. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be.
Yep.
Beautifully talented people who don't need to promote and sell themselves because they find perfect life satisfaction working with me on projects too. And I can work with them, and their skills are so amazing, they can help me with things too, you know? So there's all different kinds of artists. Not everybody has to be a rock star. I'm certainly not a rock star. I'm not Damien Hirst, you know, or whoever else out there. I'm me. And I'm along that spectrum. There's this place called Mouse Armor, somewhere between Damien Hirst and McDonald's Happy Meals, that there's a market for what I'm doing. And every artist can find their own market too.
Yeah.
But they have to be completely open and flexible to create work that fits into that niche. Mm. And hopefully they'll get some satisfaction out of that too.
Mm. That's a very... It's a great way to, like, summarize it all, you know, like, just to put it all into that perspective. Because I've had some interesting creatives on the show, whether it's musicians or painters or art, like different artists, and it's mm-hmm. I love sitting across from artists, just listen to mm-hmm. what makes them tick, because it's they've all had so many different experiences.
Yeah.
And the way you just kind of brought that all together, it was like, oh my fuck, that makes a lot of sense.
I hope so.
No, it's really cool. Thanks for doing this.
It's fun to go all the way down the rabbit hole and back up again.
That's really cool.
That's fun. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. I end the show with one question.
Yeah.
When I say Calgary, where's your head go?
Calgary. I think the city has a potential still that it to become something completely other than what it was. You know, we are still, I thought we were a city not of settlers. I thought we were a city of pioneers. I think we need to embrace that pioneer thing. Settlers about like surviving the cold winter. We got that. That's behind us. Do we still have that pioneering spirit to take on the world again from here? The Calgary could become a center for something. And I think it still has the resources. It still has, you know, whatever it has, it still has a bank account. It could cash in to transform itself into something. And I think that creative economy is where it's going to be for us. That's my, that, of course, that's self-serving. But I think the city could become a very creative place if it wanted to be.
I love that idea, the guild idea. It's like you can just kind of picture it and you can almost feel the energy of like what would happen in that space.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it'd be cool. Yeah. Thanks again for taking the time.
Yeah, if the city just gives me the budget of one rec center, I can take care of this for you.
We'll clip that. We'll clip that and send it everywhere. thanks again. This was really cool hearing it.
Yeah, thank you. It was really fun.
Thank you.
Thank you.